T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
2-1. Dave Lee here with Warren Zanes. He has written a biography. Warren teaches at NYU and, among other impressive accomplishments, was a consulting producer on the Oscar-winning 20 Feet from Stardom, which we've talked about here on this show before. But Warren, thank you for the time. Congratulations on the book. And, wow, I can't believe the access you got to Tom Petty.
Yeah, thank you. You know, there were times where I was pinching myself, surprised at the access. I think he crossed the line, made a decision for himself, and once he'd made that decision and talked to me about the possibility of a bio, I was in the right place, right time, probably brought the right spirit, and then he really gave himself.
Tell us about the origins of that relationship with Tom Petty.
Well, I first met him when I was still in my late teens. I'm 50 now. And we grew up as Petty fans. When the first record came out, we heard Breakdown on WBCN in Boston, which is one of the early supporters of the Heartbreakers' debut. And we waited for every release after that, you know, right up to Hypnotic Eye last year. But at a certain point, I started a rock and roll band with my brother, and we ended up being brought onto the Tom Petty tour the summer of 87, and we got to know him better. But it wasn't at that point. Believe me, he wasn't looking at the blonde guitar player with the chipped tooth in the opening act as a potential biographer. A lot had to take place between then and now. But I left the music business and went back to school and got a bachelor's degree, 2 master's degrees, a PhD. And along the way, I started writing and teaching about music. Wrote a book about Dusty Springfield's Dusty in Memphis. Tom read it, and that put us back in touch.
Yeah, it's a great story, all by itself. Let me ask you a number of questions about Tom Petty, but initially, Warren, why did critics put Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, as I recall, into the punk category?
I think it was just a matter of category confusion. And you had acts like, Styx, Foreigner, Boston, they were being played at rock radio. And they sounded more different from the Heartbreakers than the Heartbreakers did from the Sex Pistols. And so if you were closer to one side or the other, you could be called punk. You know, in a way, artists like Bruce Springsteen could be thrown over with punk. You know, Elvis Costello, he's done. He still came out of punk. So it was a much wider category than the Sex Pistols would suggest. And Petty wore a leather jacket on his first record, and that was enough for a lot of people.
In your talks with him, what does he consider his best album?
More than any other, he points to Wildflowers. I don't know if you would call it the best. He has described it as the one he likes the most. And I think there might be a distinction there because, he's the parent to all these children. He doesn't want to say one's better than another, I don't think. I think that's uncomfortable. But Wildflowers was an incredible period, a hard period in his life. But I think he wrote more in that time than any other time. It was a single album, but he really had 3 albums worth of finished, very high-quality material.
Why was that a hard time in his life, Warren?
I was talking to a friend the other day who knew Jim Dickinson, who's a Memphis producer who also played piano on the Stones' Wild Horses, among many other things. And Jim Dickinson said, "I wouldn't wish the job of band leader on my worst enemy." Now, Tom Petty starts this band with a group of friends from Gainesville, Florida. And once success comes, as Tom Petty said to me, somebody had to be the adult here. And he steps out as band leader, as the songwriter, the creative force, and the guy making the business decisions. And it's a rough job. And he had to choose business over friendship at many points. And I think that can create a lonely atmosphere for a band leader. He'd been doing that for a while, fighting the internal, you know, band fights that you have to stay together. He'd been in a marriage that had started out with a lot of promise and then gone darker. And he, you know, at the end of Wildflowers, which he describes as his divorce record, but it came before the divorce. But after touring on that record, he left the marriage. And I think childhood abuse, I think life slowed just long enough for this guy who had been working like a dog for about two decades that it just kind of pinned him to the mat. And to relieve himself from the pain, and believe me, he regrets this decision, he picked up heroin. And, you know, a hard time in his life got a lot harder.
Well, you referenced the amount of time that he worked, and that was interesting when I read that about the time that he spent in the studio if he wasn't playing. Can you elaborate more on that? And was and is he a recluse?
You know, in the book, Jackson Browne is among those who describes him as reclusive. I think within his community, look at the guys he's attracted, you know, Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Johnny Cash, Del Shannon. He's not a recluse within his community of peers, but he hasn't been out there in the way that a lot of rock stars have. But part of it relates to this idea of work. Nowadays, you see artists wait 5 years between records. When he came into the business, people were expected to have their next product ready, you know, within the year. It wasn't as tight a cycle as the Beatles experienced, but it was still pretty tight. And Tom was the guy. So, you know, when he's out supporting one record, you have executives, management, band members looking at him going, where are the songs? So he was in this tight loop of production that leaves very little room for a life outside of it. And nobody was telling him to slow down and spend, you know, go home and spend time with the family. Everybody wanted him to keep going in the direction he was going. They were having hits. These are guys who came from poor homes. They were tasting success. He was working, and everybody wanted him to keep doing it.
When you listen to the Eagles, you can hear those guitar licks so recognizable by Don Felder, who grew up in the same area. Did he teach Tom how to play a guitar growing up in Gainesville? And another interesting nugget in the book, you say he gave Tom the advice to start writing his own material.
Yeah. Well, Tom has always credited Don Felder with really bringing to his attention that if he wanted to go from being a local act to being a national act, it meant coming up with your own material. You know, once the Beatles kind of set the template, that's what you had to do. And Felder was the guy that Petty credits with really bringing the message to him. Don was in a band called Flo, and Petty saw them, and excuse me, he realized, like, these guys aren't playing any covers, and everybody else is playing covers. And Don made this point. As to the guitar lessons, in Don Felder's book, he was Tom Petty's guitar teacher, not in Tom Petty's book. They hung around. There was a local music store, Lipham's Music, and that was the gathering place for all, you know, some future Rock and Roll Hall of Famers. But they were just Gainesville kids who were into music. Felder was one of them. Petty was one of them. Tom says that he remembers Don showing him some stuff on piano. But you got to remember, at the time, in Tom's bands, he wasn't even the guitar player. He was the bass player.
Yeah.
So it doesn't exactly make sense, but they were definitely, Don Felder cast a pretty big shadow and did influence some younger guys, Petty among them.
Well, as long as you mention guitar players, longtime heartbreaker Mike Campbell, that is a bond they form a long time. How in the world did that last so long?
Well, I think this goes back again to Petty's strengths as a band leader. Petty was often willing to make sacrifices that made his world a little more insular, even within the band, in order to keep the band together. And I think Mike Campbell, too, should be credited with being, you know, at times not being everything he could be in order to fit into his place in the band. If everybody is just too big, then you can't keep the band together. They got to think of themselves relative to the structure of this unit. Campbell's done that, but part of what I think, probably the biggest part, is Petty and Campbell are two song guys. You know, there are songs where Mike Campbell is not showing you even close to what he can do because the song isn't asking him to do it. And when they come in, they're looking at the song and how to turn that song into a record. And that's their focus. There are a lot of guitar players who have, you know, not even half the chops of Mike Campbell, who overplay and kill songs. And Mike Campbell has only ever made songs better. He has never killed a song because his guitar-playing ego gets in the way. But as a result, you look at the list of 100 greatest guitar players in Rolling Stones, like, where's Mike Campbell?
Yeah. You know,
he's under-recognized for how good he is.
Ben Montench has been there a long time, too.
An incredible player. I mean, both these guys get lots of studio work because the musicians know how good they are. But these guys, in terms of what they're bringing as players, they are at the top of their field.
Let me get the Minnesota connection here, if I can. You referenced it where he backed Bob Dylan and, of course, the Traveling Wilburys. How did that happen, and what was that relationship like with Dylan, who's a very quiet guy normally?
Well, it came about, you know, shortly after Live Aid. At Live Aid, Dylan played with Keith Richards and Ron Wood from the Stones. And from some perspectives, it was a little sloppier than likely made Dylan comfortable. And then his next outing was Farm Aid. It was the first Farm Aid. Dylan had made some comments in his Live Aid performance about, you know, this is great what we're doing, but maybe we could do something for the American farmer. And so when he went to play Farm Aid, being the kind of godfather of the idea, he reached out to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers to back him. And they did that show with no plans to do anything more than that, and it became, you know, because of the, you know, quality of the experience, it became about 2 years of road work with those guys going out with Dylan. But it's funny, when you start to ask people, you know, tell me about your relationship with Dylan, nobody says much of anything. I've never run into anybody who talks. And Elliot Roberts, who was managing Dylan at the time, he said, I don't like to say a whole lot about Bob, and maybe that's why I have a relationship with him today. You know, which that to me it encapsulates it. And, you know, Tom's pretty reserved on that front, too. You know, there are definitely some Dylan stories in the book, you know, some that I consider among the best stories in the book. But mostly these guys will just share the honest truth is Dylan was a giant in their world.
Well, the book is great. It's called Petty, the biography with Warren Zanes. We're talking with Warren. And if I can get to one story that intrigued me, Warren, I had never heard it before. I'd never read it, and then I read it in your book. The Fox Theater in Atlanta. Ray Davies of the Kinks at a sound check. Can you recall that story?
Yeah. Well, this is still when, you know, you can have bands that are starting to get gold records, but they're still doing opening slots on tours. And so at Fox Theater, at that particular show, Heartbreakers had a couple hits, but they're still doing it. And they're on a bill, and it's Blondie opening, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and the Kinks. The Kinks have finished sound check, and Ray Davies is still out there, and he's sitting at a piano, and he's playing Tired of Waiting, the Kinks song. And he just keeps playing it, tired of waiting for you. And they're all looking at him like, you know, we got two bands to check here. And he just keeps doing it, and Petty's, like, well aware that he's just messing with them. And finally says, pack the gear. we're out of here, pack the gear. And that gets a few people's attention, among them another member of the Kinks. And what you find then is two heroes of the British invasion getting into a fist fight while the Heartbreakers are watching. And the culmination of it was that Ray got off the stage, they moved the gear back and made room for the Heartbreakers. But that kind of ridiculousness is not that uncommon, and that was around the time that Petty, he was having a conversation with Bruce Springsteen, and Bruce had already stopped doing any opening shows, and Tom was ready to do the same and followed suit.
Well, and the book is loaded with stories like that that are great. In fact, Stevie Nicks is quoted in your book as saying, if Tom Petty ever were to ask me to leave Fleetwood Mac and join him, I'd probably do it. And then Stop Dragging My Heart Around, of course, took the nation by storm. Was it already written for the band, and how did Stevie Nicks become a part of that?
Well, she was a great subject to talk to for the book. She's really, really animated, full of life, very funny, very smart. But she was an interesting character in their story, because when you think of how big Fleetwood Mac was in, you know, around the mid second half of the 70s, they were just the biggest act in the world, and she became such a fan of the Heartbreakers that she was going around town saying exactly as you say, that she would be willing to join the band if asked. And Tom Petty says they kind of shied away from, you know, answering her calls to management, and she just kept at it and, you know, wanted to meet this guy, and gets to him through Jimmy Iovine, who very quickly starts a relationship with Stevie that they hide from Tom. So it's all kinds of, you know, interesting stuff there. But they had cut Stop Dragging My Heart Around, and she wanted Tom to write a song for her, and he wrote Insider, which ends up on the Hard Promises record. He wrote Insider, and as he was recording it so to show her, he thought, this might be one of my best songs I've ever written. And he just went to her and said, I'm not giving you the song. So they were looking around for something more. They had Stop Dragging My Heart Around in the can, turned it into a duet. Stevie releases it. It goes to number one. The problem was that when the Heartbreakers put out The Waiting and Woman in Love, they couldn't get the attention to radio that they needed because there was this other Heartbreaker song out there. And to the ear, it didn't sound like Stevie Nicks. It sounded like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers with Stevie Nicks, you know, taking a vocal on it.
Yeah.
And so it created its own problems. They ended up, you know, it all balanced out in time when he stole another song later on. But what I love is that friendship has persisted. You know, Stevie Nicks, you know, from knocking on that door down at the outset, she just stayed there. And I think she's a really, like, loving personality in his life, which, you know, as we were saying, was oftentimes quite reclusive.
The Traveling Wilburys, boy, that was a monster group.
Yeah, that's an incredible story that, you know, frankly gives me faith in life in general, because Petty, more than once, he described his experience being the band leader in the Heartbreakers as lonely. And I think it was at a peak around the time that he meets George Harrison. And, you know, George Harrison comes into his life, and they meet at the end of the Dylan tours. And after just a couple days, George Harrison goes up, hugs Tom Petty, and says, I'm in your life now, Tommy. Hmm. And that's what he was like. Just like this force of positivity when Petty really needed it. You know, it's the kind of thing, you know, we all need it at some point, and hopefully we all get it. Tom Petty got it in the form of a Beatle.
Wow. Was Elvis an influence?
Yeah. What I love about the Tom Petty story is his arc really takes you through the entirety. You know, we were talking before about Pearl Jam opening up for Petty. So, you know, there's petty today, young bands looking up to him. But when he was 10, he first meets Elvis Presley, shakes his hand on a movie set, and that, like, ignites things for Petty, and the engine is started, and it's rock and roll from there on out. But you've got, you look at his story, it's like, there's Elvis Presley, there's Bob Dylan, there's George Harrison, there's Johnny Cash, there's Pearl Jam, you know, there's Dave Grohl. You've got just a ridiculous number of major figures in American music embedded in this story. So when you study Tom Petty, you study the history of rock and roll and its main characters.
Warren, as a writer and a musician, which just seems to be a rare commodity that you've done in your career here, is there a Petty song that is, I'm not going to ask you for a favorite, but that is more memorable to you than any of the others?
I give probably a different answer to this question every time it's asked, and that doesn't mean my answer is inauthentic. It really does move around. I'll say The Waiting right now. We were just talking about it, but I haven't fallen in love too many times in my life when The Waiting wasn't the song that I used to kind of process those feelings. You know, I hopefully I'm not going to keep falling in love, because it's a hard business there. But when it happens, like The Waiting, you know, it just starts off, oh, baby, don't it feel like heaven right now? Don't it feel like something from a dream? And the way he sings those words, it's, to me, one of the greatest love songs ever written.
1979, you write the Tom Petty files for bankruptcy. Next year, he's on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Ripping a dollar bill in half. No, that's not the first cover. I'm sorry. It's the For Hard Promises, when he tried to bring the album prices down, that he's ripping the dollar in half. Yeah, Damn the Torpedoes is the third record, and that's the breakthrough, but it only came after Petty went to court to file for bankruptcy. You know, like Stan Lynch in the band says, I had a gold record on my wall, and I was driving a crappy Ford Granada. Something wasn't right with this picture. You know, but that's the case with a lot of young bands. But Petty had his eye on a longer career, so he had to change that contract. And that was the kind of courtroom strategy they took, was to declare bankruptcy. It got people's attention. I think within the industry it was looked at as, if this kid succeeds in this, he's setting a precedent that's bad for all of us. So there was a lot of attention on this guy, and it ended up that they settled in order to avoid that, but he renegotiated that contract. But he signed his original contract thinking that publishing meant songbooks. He didn't realize that when he signed over his publishing, that he was handing over the motherlode of income.
Which brings up another question. I'll let you go, Warren. I know I've already taken a lot of your time here, but it's so fascinating to me. The book is great. It's called Petty, the Biography by Warren Zanes. But talking about his writing skills, how did he learn to write so well if school, as you talk about early in the book, never really appealed to him?
Yeah. There's a few kind of dimensions to that answer. One is, he really makes a case for the role that television can have in a young person's life. I think he felt like television raised him. There he is in an abusive home. He's disconnected from school, and he falls in love with Westerns. Well, you know, even at TV, a lot of those Westerns are written by people who can write. So if you are attuned to dialogue, you're going to pick something up. But here he is also, he's in the 60s. Some of the greatest songwriting is coming his way through AM radio. He's just got his antennae up. So he is, in a lot of respects, self-educated, but he's got amazing material after him. And I think one of the most important things is that he's got this sense of taste. You know, not every Western has the great dialogue. Not every song coming out of AM radio has the lyrics, but he starts to ascertain where the quality is And that's how the self-education process unfolds. And he doesn't come right out of the box, the great writer that he would become. So the other element is just work. I mean, this guy worked. And at the end of all the interviews with him, I looked at him and I went, I see the talent. I see that incredible band. But the thing I really see is a working man. And, you know, I try to remind my own kids, like, you know, don't sit and wait for your talent to catch up with you. You know, get to work, because the guys who break through, they are workers.
Well said, Warren. Appreciate your time. Congrats on the book. I really enjoyed the heck out of it. And as we head toward the holidays, it's about a perfect gift as I can think of for a rock and roller.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking.
Yeah, thanks, Warren, and best of luck and continued success in the next ride. Do you know what you're going to work on next, by the way?
I got an inkling, but I'm too superstitious to say anything about it.
That wasn't a Stevie Wonder reference, was it?
Oh!
We'll look forward to it, Warren. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.